This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/book review.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, we chat with Charles McGrath, the Times' writer-at-large, about the strange controversy surrounding Swedish bestseller Stieg Larsson. Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Garrett Kaiser tells us about noise in his book, The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want. And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Well, suddenly, many authors are writing about a new subject, rather an old one, noise. There are a number of new books on the topic, and perhaps the very best is called The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. It's by Garrett Kaiser. It's reviewed in this week's book review by Ted Conover, who says that Kaiser has really wrestled with the noise question and comes away with a great deal to say about it. And what Conover also admires is the succession of unexpected ideas about the links between noise, politics, and technology. I'm delighted that Garrett Kaiser is joining us through the technological intercession of a noisy telephone conversation. And welcome.
Thank you.
Are Americans particularly noisy people?
Well, not having known lots of other people in other nations, I can't say that definitively. We certainly are a nation in which there's a fair amount of loudness, and also we are not a soft-spoken nation in the world as far as our politics go. You know, we have several factors that tend to make our nation loud. We're a prosperous nation, and the prosperity gives us the means to buy lots of stuff. We're an inventive nation, so we're constantly developing new stuff. And we're a big nation geographically, and that relates to noise in a couple of ways. First, transportation is going to be very important and has been in helping us negotiate those big spaces. And transportation makes noise. It's the largest single source of noise in the world today. And also, at least historically, we've had greater opportunities to move away from noise to some other place, something people in small nations have not had for centuries. But that space is running out. And then finally, we're a culture that sets a pretty high premium on the individual and on his or her desires and rights. And that's a good recipe for a noise dispute, with the noise maker feeling that, you know, it's pretty much my right to generate what sound I want to, and the person disturbed also feeling, well, it's my right to have an uninvaded acoustical space.
Well, in fact, you're right. A person who says my noise is my right basically means your ear is my hole. There is an implied kind of aggressiveness in all this. Is that right?
Well, yes, and sometimes one is interpreting thoughtlessness as aggressiveness. But it's in the character of noise that, you know, it can cross boundaries and it can invade spaces. And because it's something that we don't see, we sometimes regard it maybe less seriously than we ought to. An example that I sometimes use is if I drive by your house and I throw a piece of trash out of my car into your window and into your child's nursery, you're going to come out of that house pretty ripping, and you may even call a cop. But if I drive by your house and send the decibels of my car radio into your child's nursery, waking that child who may be sick, it's just one of those things that happen.
And here's a basic question. What is noise? What makes noise different from the sounds we hear in the course of a normal day?
Well, noise is defined in lots of different ways, and I've abided by the a standard definition, which, like all definitions, has its problems, as unwanted sound, sound that's out of place. Most of us want to hear some cheering and screaming at a ball game. We may not want to hear it during the exchange of vows at a wedding. and sound that has the potential to be harmful, either to social intercourse when it drowns out conversation, when it makes public spaces unwelcoming, but also sound that can cause damage to us in terms of health problems and also damage to ecosystems and other creatures.
Have ideas about what constitutes noise changed over time? I mean, not only that obviously there was more noise than there was, let's say, 1,000 years ago, but also at what constitutes an acceptable type of noise or volume? Is that something that technology has altered?
Well, it's changing all the time, and technology's played a significant role in at least two ways. First, when sound began to be measured as a phenomenon and you know, people started using things, measurements like decibels and that, what had previously been viewed as an annoyance and in some case as the annoyance of cranks now had an objective basis. And that's proved to be a mixed blessing. On the one hand, science can corroborate the evidence of our ears. Some have claimed it has also usurped the credibility of our ears so that hearing a noise and complaining about it is not valid unless an acoustician comes and certifies it. Science and technology have also contributed to our understanding of noise in that noise has objective measurable factors, as all sound does, but there's also a subjective factor to noise that causes us to call a sound noise, and we're making a judgment, and that's variable, as human beings are variable in their tastes and cultures, and that makes it an interesting subject. And what we often find is that the sound of something new or strange is perceived as noise because it frightens us or it annoys us. And a good example of that is the railroad. When railroads first came in the 19th century, there were people who complained about the noise of them. There are still people who complain about the noise of them. But over time, there came to be a shift so that for some folks now, there's a nostalgia associated with that long, lonesome railroad horn that might not have been perceived as such by our ancestors who were hearing it for the first time.
Thanks a lot, Garrett Kaiser. It's Garrett Kaiser, whose new book, The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Botsman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
So the big BEA spectacle. What'd you see? What'd you learn?
The big jamboree. Well, it was my first BEA. So this is, of course, the annual convention where it's booksellers, publishers, authors, and everybody gets together. And it was very retail politics, you know, at its core. It was, you know, a lot of booksellers grabbing up free galleys, authors on panels, and publishers trying to decide how nervous they should be about ebooks.
They're kind of getting bigger and bigger, right? You report in your story, they're taking over, I mean, what's now not enormous, but consequential size of the market of actual book sales. Is that right?
That's right. I think last year at this time, it was about 3% of the total trade books market. This year, some of the major publishers, even though they don't release their sales figures publicly, they said privately that it's about 8 to 10% based on their first quarter of this year. So it is small but growing, and there's a lot of debate over how quickly it will grow and how big it will be.
And what do authors think of ebooks? Have you had a chance to sound them out on this and get their impressions?
Authors are very worried. For one thing, there's the issue of royalties, which of course authors and agents are very concerned about because authors earn much higher royalties for hardcover books than for paperbacks or ebooks. So they're very concerned about their own compensation. At the same time, they want to gain more readers. They want a bigger audience. So some authors are genuinely torn by it. And then there are authors like John Grisham who only recently started allowing his books to be sold as ebooks.
And what about the iPad and all of this? I mean, is this still pretty much Amazon Kindle that's dominating the show?
It's very much the battle of the devices right now. I mean, you have the Kindle, of course. You have Barnes & Noble with the Nook. Borders is set to introduce its own device, I believe, next month. And the people who have iPads can't stop talking about what a wonderful gadget it is for reading books. But it's still a little early. I mean, I think that no one really knows how the iPad will take off this year, because it's only been out for about a month now.
Well, I guess we'll be learning more in the months ahead.
Yes, we will.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
You're welcome.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One book to consider is Innocent by bestselling author Scott Turow. Innocent continues the presumed innocent story 22 years later with what Publishers Weekly describes as, quote, mesmerizing prose and intricate plotting. That's Innocent by Scott Turow, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
There's been no more spectacular posthumous career than that of the Swedish author Stieg Larsson. Only his afterlife turns out to be even more remarkable in some way than the novels he left behind. The Times' writer-at-large Charles McGrath, also my esteemed predecessor here at the Book Review, has been investigating the case of Stieg Larsson, has written a terrific story about it for the New York Times Magazine, and Chip is here to talk about it. Hi, Chip.
Hi.
What's going on there? There's a big battle over his estate. Is
well,
that right?
That's the main thing that's going on. Larsson lived for 30 years with a woman named Eva Gabrielsson, who was an architect. But he never made a will, and they had no children. And oddly, in Sweden, which we think of as a model of liberal enlightenment, Sweden has no common law marriage law, such as we have in many states. So all the estate, which is now worth a lot of money.
We mean like many.
Many millions of dollars. And it will only be more because there have already been three movies made in Sweden of the books, but they've just been signed. They're going to make three American movies, which will fill the coffers again.
And Chip, just to remind listeners the titles of these books.
Titles are, the first one is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The second is The Girl Who Played with Fire, and the third is The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest.
And huge successes, international successes.
Huge successes. So as we were saying, so the estate is worth a great deal of money, and Eva Gabrielsson got nothing. She didn't even get the half of the apartment that she shared with Stieg Larsson. All the money, all the rights to the books went to his father and his brother, who live up in Umeå, which is in the northern part of Sweden, which in some ways is a world apart from sophisticated Stockholm.
And that's where Larsson lived in
Stockholm.
That's
where Larsson grew up, yeah. And then he moved to Stockholm. So there's this huge fight now in Sweden where Eva Gabrielsson has been an object of intense sympathy, and the father and the brother have been somewhat reviled for being greedy and uncomprehending. I think the story is a little more interesting than that. I actually went up to Umeå and met with the father and the brother who did not strike me as greedy. I think, in fact, they're somewhat overwhelmed by the responsibility of this estate and are trying to deal with it. Meanwhile, both parties have said a great many hurtful things to each other. The Larssons have said that Eva Gabrielsson is mentally unstable. She has said that Stieg was not close to them. He was basically estranged from them, and so that makes it doubly unjust that this fortune should go to them. That's where things stand. It's sort of tragic in a way, and yet it's also a story that has all of Sweden paying attention to the papers because it's there all the time.
Chip, if there's no common law provision in Sweden, does that mean there's no legal contest here?
There's no legal contest. She has been asserting a kind of moral claim, and I think that public opinion in Sweden is overwhelmingly on her side. The other thing she has as a kind of bargaining chip is that she has Larsson's laptop computer on which there is probably a half to three quarters of a fourth novel and possibly an outline and even some chapters of a fifth and sixth novel. So this computer is tremendously valuable. And she has said that she doesn't want the fourth novel ever published. I'm not sure that she might not come around because this is the thing that she has over the father and the brother and the thing that might force them to make some kind of settlement with her because they do want to see this fourth book published.
Now, Larson was about 50 when he died. What did he die of?
Well, he died most likely of a massive heart attack. He took terrible care of himself. He lived on junk food, cigarettes and coffee as far as we can make out. There's some speculation in Sweden that he was murdered. His main job was not writing novels. These are the first novels he ever wrote. His main job was he was a crusading journalist whose specialty was exposing the right-wing extremism and neo-Nazism in Sweden, of which there is surprisingly or not surprisingly maybe quite a bit. And he was the object of many death threats. And so there's a conspiracy theory that suggests that he was murdered. I think most likely he died of a heart attack.
Why did the books become so successful internationally? This is one of the handful of most famous and best-selling authors of our time.
Well, that's another great mystery. I mean, part of it, of course, is that these books sometimes become viral. You know, this happened to the Dan Brown books. It happened to the Khalid Husseini Kite Runner. I mean, at a certain point, the success fuels itself and ceases to bear any relation to the books themselves. I can only speak as an American reader, not as a European one. When the books were hugely successful there before they came here, I think they have two things going for them. One is they offer a richly detailed portrait of Sweden, which turns out to be a fascinating country. It's not Ingmar Bergman land or IKEA land. It's a country in some ways that's a lot like our own. And there's a kind of density and social texture to these novels that you don't always get in thrillers. The other thing is it has a great character. The detectives in these things are a pair. There's a guy who's a Mikael Blomqvist, who's a journalist, and he has this sidekick, Lisbeth Salander, who is someone that we've never seen in literature before. She's tattooed, pierced, dysfunctional computer hacker who lives on the margins with her own kind of code of ethics and vengeance. And she's utterly fascinating. I think that's a big part of why people are interested in these books, which, as it happens, also have a kind of journalistic subtext. I mean, there's a sort of feminist agenda. The title of the first book in Swedish is Men Who Hate Women, and there is some of that. The book is the books, all three, are in some ways an expose of all of the ways in which men behave badly toward women. And they're page turners like all good thrillers, but they have, as I say, they have this kind of density and extra interest.
Thanks a lot, Chip.
You're welcome.
That's Charles McGrath, former editor of the Book Review and writer at large for the New York Times. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, before what's new, I'll tell you what's old. Laura Bush, still on top.
Well, the first lady indeed.
Yep, still on top of the nonfiction list with her memoir, Spoken from the Heart, followed closely by Michael Lewis with his book, The Big Short. A couple of newcomers, Sebastian Junger enters at number three with his latest book, War. The Perfect Storm, his first book, spent almost 200 weeks on the hardcover and paperback list. So this guy's a trooper. For this book, he was embedded with American troops in Afghanistan. Pretty harrowing stuff recounted here. And Dexter Filkins, our reviewer, liked the book quite a lot. The most interesting story on the nonfiction list this week is the book that is at number six. It's Justin Halpern's book, Stuff My Dad Says.
Kind of a euphemism.
Yes. Let's just say his dad doesn't say stuff. It's something rather stronger that we can't say on a family podcast. The story is basically Halpern was an aspiring comedy writer who at age 28 or so last August had to move back in with his parents after a breakup, and he started this Twitter feed based on these sort of outrageous, obscene, irascible things his dad would say. They were just these great little quips. And It really took off on the strength of fewer than 100 Twitter posts. And keep in mind, these are 140 characters long. He ended up getting a book contract. Now he's on the bestseller list and a TV deal. So a series based on it, which will be called Bleep, My Dad Says, starring William Shatner, just got picked up by one of the networks.
And the fact is, some of it is true wisdom. This guy's very funny and shrewd and sharp, the
yes,
father.
And supposedly the father, who's a retired doctor, doesn't read the Twitter feed, refuses to grant interviews. He's completely uninterested in being a celebrity. Rather refreshing.
Yes. What about the fiction list?
Speaking of celebrities, Charlene Harris is still on top with Dead in the Family, the latest of her Sookie Stackhouse vampire stories. A couple new books. Emily Giffen's Heart of the Matter enters at number 2, followed by the latest from Douglas Preston, Fever Dream. There's an interesting story on the fiction list this week, too. Tom Rackman's newspaper satire, The Imperfectionists, entered last week at 13. This week it climbs to number 8.
Got tremendous reviews. I mean,
yeah.
Christopher Buckley loved it for us.
Yeah, reviewed it on the cover earlier this month.
Janet Maslin liked it just as much in the Daily. It's getting great reviews everywhere.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe there's a little bit of kind of journalist back-scratching going on. As you recall, it's a satiric novel about the goings-on at a kind of moribund English-language newspaper in Rome. You know, the proprietor talks only to his dog. The obituary writer is, you know, only slightly more alive than the people he writes about. And, you know, there's a female editor who, in the words of one reviewer summing it up, is torn between her need to hang on to the job and her desperate desire to be sacked. This does not sound like any newspaper I've ever heard of, read, or worked at, that's for sure.
Although the author was himself employed at the International Herald Tribune.
Yes, which is owned by the New York Times. But, you know, obviously the atmosphere there must be completely more downbeat.
What about last week's cover boy, Martin Amis? How's he doing?
His novel, The Pregnant Widow, is doing fairly well, lands at number 28 on the extended list, which, you know, hate to say it, but for serious literary novels,
that's pretty good.
Not that bad these days. Yeah. Another interesting literary novel, The Lonely Polygamist by Brady Udall, enters at number 30. That, if you recall, we reviewed that recently.
We did.
About a Mormon patriarch who has 4 wives, 28 kids, and lots of problems.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.